hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts Jacob Cazell, Jeff Chaney, and Todd Singer.
Welcome, everyone, to the No Better Than Average podcast, episode 125. I'm Todd Singer, and I'm here with my co-host, Jacob Cazell. I can almost say it after all these years.
Almost.
Jacob, how's it going?
You know, I'm doing pretty good. Had a nice weekend. Managed to survive the floods. I live in a town that is surrounded by creeks and rivers, and there were all sorts of flood warnings after the monsoon, yep, the deluge that rolled through Indiana this past week. And for our nerdier listeners, those that work in enterprise IT, you will appreciate this. Right before, like literally a half an hour before Todd and I sat down to record tonight, I got an email from one of our technical users that I can't log into the database, our production database, and I went and looked, and what do you know, I can't either. And so I rousted one of our DBAs who logged in and scratched his head a bit and said, well, it looks like you had an Oracle node eviction. So, yeah, just very nonchalant. No notifications about it or anything. It just, one of the nodes fell over and went boom. And, managed to get that right back online just minutes before jumping on here to record with Todd. So, hopefully the world is not burning on the other side of my life outside of the podcast. So
that's for Monday. That's for tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, it's just our payroll system. It's, this week's not a pay week, it's next week, so we're fine for a few more days.
Yeah, speaking of surviving, I survived my daughter's birthday party. We had 10 girls of about, they would range from in age, I guess, from 5 to 8. And it was a cooking party, so they did cooking stuff, and I was just the gopher and such. And then, of course, we didn't want to have a sleepover, because that's even crazier.
Oh, I can't imagine.
You know, the girls don't sleep, for one thing. And so we ran it till 9 p.m. About 10 till 9, my wife says, "You need to come upstairs right now." And so we have the interior doors where you pull down the handle and it retracts the bolt.
Okay.
And the door opens. And this has happened to us before. You pull down the handle and the bolt does not disengage. So something is broken between the handle and the bolt. So the bolt just stays in. So the door is closed. Oh. Will not open. Doesn't matter if it's locked or not. Will not open. And we had 5 girls, including my daughter, trapped in her room.
How much screaming was there? Was that the noise that I heard all the way over on the north side of town?
You would have heard them earlier when they first got here. They were outside, you know, running around with sonar, screaming and such. But no, the girls were fine, and we were getting all kinds of suggestions, you know, from inside the door. Well, you can go get a ladder, and we can go get on the roof. Let's call that Plan B, okay? And you know, I was telling the parents, well, it looks like it's going to turn into a sleepover after all.
But whether we like it or not, they're locked in. Did you have them all sign a liability waiver before they came over? Now, your daughter may be on the roof on a ladder. Probably not, but maybe.
This is the panic room part of the party. No, we didn't do that. But fortunately, one of our listeners, John, and my brother-in-law worked at the door. And after about a half hour, they got the handle all out with a drill and 2 screwdrivers and a little bit of black magic.
That does not sound good.
Yeah, well, it is good. Because the last time this happened, my wife was locked in the bathroom. And I only have one move, and that is put a shoulder to the door. Well, I have 2 moves. I can either put my right shoulder into the door or my left shoulder into the door. But, you know, that kind of busts the whole door, including the frame. So
right,
we had to have something that replace it. This time, we just went to Lowe's, got a new handle, and my brother-in-law was kind enough to install it. Again, I did my standard troubleshooting. Can I fix this in Excel? No. You better get somebody else. Pivot table
the door open?
Can't pivot table the handle back into the door. So enlisted somebody else. We you know, we fed him and his family, and he reinstalled the handle. So everything's back to normal.
So what I'm hearing is you might have a lawsuit on your hands if this has happened with two different door handles. This is like faulty hardware.
Maybe it's we got the same one though to replace it, so you know, they look really good. So, I mean, that's the important thing, right?
These match. Door handles look great. Never shut the door, for the love of God. Don't shut, but they look amazing,
especially if you're by yourself.
Oh man, that is not good. Well, yeah, I fortunately have not entered the age and era of slumber parties yet. I'm not looking forward to that, but yeah, I can only imagine.
We tend to rent someplace out. Like last year we did a U-Paint pottery place, and that was nice. I have a feeling next year we'll be doing the same thing. Maybe we can do every other year host a party.
Yeah.
But I know I got out today and mowed the lawn after all the rain. I couldn't mow Tuesday, so I had grass up to the knees or whatever, but I got out there, and I think our co-host Jeff also did, and sadly that triggered his allergies. So he won't be joining us tonight, but I'm sure he'll be back next week. We had to squeeze this in because I got a business trip coming up. Daytona. I will be swinging by the Speedway.
Cool.
And one of our vendors is actually paying for us to go through the Richard Petty driving experience.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'll get to ride along in a NASCAR around the Daytona track. We'll see if I survive.
Now, will they let you take the wheel? Or
God, no.
You just sit there and they drive it.
Okay. Let me ask you, can I drive this car with Excel?
Again, no? Going back to your one move.
Okay, let's have somebody else drive then.
But you are an adult. You drive presumably every other day at least.
Yes, that's true. Just
maybe
not
at 140 miles an hour.
Most of my route is right turn, so I wouldn't be able to handle a NASCAR. So please check us out on the web. We're at facebook.com/knowbettershow. You can call into our comment line and leave a question or a comment, 317-643-1212. You can send us an email, feedback@knowbettershow.com. And with that, let's jump into the notes. What do we got tonight?
So we actually have a call from Howie I can't remember if he's in Vancouver. He's out on the East Coast, I think, in Canada. So we will jump in and hear what Howie has to say here.
Hi, guys. This is Howie from Canada. I can join your show and number one podcast every week. Period. It's the best podcast out there, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, I just got back from a trip to London, England, and a couple of free points that I think you guys might be interested in. Number one is that Apple Pay, in Canada, is pretty much ubiquitous. Everywhere you go, there's tap to pay, and they always take your watch or your phone, and nobody raises their eyebrows. They're very used. Second thing is that I picked up a strap for my Series 1 Black Apple Watch. I picked up one of the new Nike brands, bands that are out. It's the light gray one with the white holes. So it's kind of, I have a nice little sort of black and gray thing going on my wrist now. I'm enjoying that very much. And the third thing, you guys have been talking about beer a lot lately. I got to say, I really enjoy bitter ale I found all through London. We pretty much ate most of our meals in pubs because the food is a little bit more economical, I find, than the restaurants. Good food, relatively inexpensive. And every different pub has its own varieties of beers. But I put stuck to different shades of bitters this time. I enjoy them. Sadly, while we can get a lot of Irish in this part of Canada, you don't see much English. The closest I can find in the liquor store, you can buy this cans of Old Speckled Hen. It's pretty good, although a little heavier in alcohol than ones that I was having in London, 5% versus about 4%. Anyway, something you guys might want to try, Old Speckled Hen, if you want to get a bit of a flavor for what bitter in an English pub is like. Anyway, keep up the good work. Keep pumping out the shows. We'll all keep them. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So a lot to unpack there. Apple Pay, the Nike band for his Apple Watch, and beer. I mean, three things that are pretty awesome individually. I think adding all three together makes them even better. Are you doing much contactless payment on the Android side, Todd? I know Jeff does with his Samsung.
So I do use it frequently because Meijer is our mm-hmm. grocery store.
Yep.
And I was just there today, works great. About 2 weeks ago, I was in a Walmart, and Walmart Pay would not work. You know, I went to the self-service scanner. I held it up there. I tried for a good couple minutes trying to get the barcode to read, and it just wouldn't read. So points to Meijer and Android Pay, but not to Walmart Pay.
Yeah, we shop at Meijer a lot, and the NFC payments work really well there,
mm-hmm.
and so few other places that we go on a regular basis do contactless payments, and having been compromised, you know, recently with my credit card and having to get it replaced and the hassle that goes with that, that really irritates me because, you know, I want that tokenized security.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere that I can do it, I try to. Not enough places do it here. So, I mean, we need to make it more ubiquitous. I didn't realize it was as widespread in Canada. I don't know quite what the problem is here. Come on, Lowe's, get your act together. I was just at Lowe's today, and they do not do any sort of wireless payments. That's kind of frustrating.
It's so hit or miss. I just think there's so many stakeholders in the U.S. because, like, in Canada, there's what, three banks? So all you got to do is get three people. You'd be surprised. There's three big ones, and you just have to get a few people to agree. All right, here's the standards, here's the specs. And in the U.S., there's a lot more. The reason I'm kind of joking about that is because we ran into that with my former place of employment. They were trying to get wire ACH set up, and they thought it would be just like Canada. And it turns out, well, no, there's a lot more banks to work with in the U.S. So, but anyway, I think that's the reason. And of course, you got Walmart wanting to do its own thing. You had CVS wanting to do their own system and go and bypass cards. So I think that's it. But it is sad. I mean, 6 months after these, chip readers have been installed, the terminals, at least half of them don't take chip cards in even.
Yeah, there's a lot that have the little piece of cardboard that they've stuck in that says, you know, no chip. And I do have a beef with that. So when I got my new card, I got it replaced at my bank with a non-chip card, and that's not good enough. So they sent me a chip card, and the PIN didn't match anything that I knew. And I was at a Kroger grocery store, and when you swipe a chip card at a Kroger, it says insert the chip, dummy. You can't do this.
Right.
So I swiped it a couple of times. Nope, insert the chip, you dummy. So I insert the chip. It'll only process it as a debit card. I gotta have a PIN, and it wouldn't let me. So I'm literally ready to rip the register off of the wall. Fortunately, my wife was there. Cooler heads prevailed. She put her card in. And then I had to go back to the bank and have them reset the PIN on the new card that they sent me because it didn't match anything that I knew. And I'm way too old to learn four new numbers in a sequence. Silly banks.
Yeah, that's just wrong.
I can't speak to Walmart specifically. I know Jeff has said good things about their payment system, but I have used the Sam's Club, Scan and Go, and that works really well. Now, the difference with that is you don't have to deal with the register at all, which is great. As you walk about the store and put the giant rolls of toilet paper and, 40 gallons of ketchup into your cart, you just hold your camera phone up over the barcode. It puts it right into your virtual cart. And when you're ready to check out, it charges whatever credit card you have on file. And when you walk out the door, instead of swiping a marker across your screen, it displays a barcode and they zap the barcode and you're on your way. I mean, you still have to stand in line and wait, which can get bad depending on when you go, but you can avoid the checkout lines completely.
Yeah.
And at Sam's Club, that is huge.
So, I know. I kind of cheated today because I had about 15 items in my cart at Meijer, and all the self-scan, the limits were all backed up, and there was 12 items or less available. So I went right to it.
You rebel.
I know. I don't usually do that, but it was going to be a long time to wait.
And those three items be damned.
Exactly. I'm pretty efficient.
Todd is going through. Todd is breaking laws. I do want to also point out from what Howie said that he picked up the Nike brand Apple Band, and those are really nice. I have a handful of the ripoff Nike style bands for my Apple Watch. My wife has one or two of those as well. I got her an Apple Watch for her birthday, and they're nice. There's definitely no doubt about it. But I've had a chance to fondle the real deal in the stores. And I can't bring myself to pay that premium because I think the ones I got were in the like $7 to $10 price range. And that Apple one is $49.95.
Yeah.
But man, it is a case of, you know, it's nicer. There is no question about it. It's more supple. It's just softer. It feels better. I could give two thumbs up to the official Nike band. They're really nice. I've got, like I said, I got a handful of the knockoffs, but man, there's something to be said for those actual Apple official bands.
Father's Day is coming up. Maybe you'll get a gift.
Well, you know, and it's kind of funny because I have always been the watch band guy, and you know, with the Apple Watch, I've bought a lot. And so, like I said, I got my wife an Apple Watch for her birthday a few weeks ago, and so she's gone a little nuts, and she actually found one. She said, "Hey, I think you might like this one," and so she ordered it, and I'm kind of holding it up to the webcam. It's kind of like a military OD green NATO style strap, and I got it, and I really liked it, and then she was looking on Amazon again, and she found me a nice orange one from the same company. So she ordered that one for me. So now I've got two new watch bands that I quite like, and they are both relatively inexpensive. And you get what you pay for, too, because I was out yesterday and noticed that the strap fell off of the green one. And looking down, the stupid little screws fell out. And almost lost the band and the watch and all of that fun stuff. Fortunately, I noticed it. I went to the store and got myself some Loctite, thinking I'll put some Loctite on these suckers. And did both bands while I was at it. And so there's 8 little screws in total on the two bands. And out of 8 screws, 3 had Loctite applied to them. The other 5 did not. So, that is the quality that you are getting when you're buying those cheap bands on Amazon. But
not a good ratio.
When they work well. And when they don't, they fall off.
So I've actually had Old Speckled Hen recommended to me by a coworker.
Okay.
But I have not had the opportunity to try it yet. I did a quick search here, and sadly, the closest that's listed on this website anyway is 100 miles away. So,
well, but you drive to get the 3 Floyds.
Well, I drive to the liquor store that's 5 minutes from my house. Well, 10 minutes from my house.
Okay. I thought you had made special pilgrimages specifically to the brewery.
I've done that a couple times. That's true. But most of the time, I can, if you know what day 3 Floyds is delivered at that liquor store, you can get there and pick up a 6-pack. They even have 3 Floyds at Meijer now.
Oh, well, that's cool.
They don't have the ultra rare zombie dust, but they do have Yum Yum, and it's a very nice pale ale. So most breweries, that would be their best pale ale. It's just 3 Floyds has a couple that are better.
Huh. Well, you know, and what's interesting is I typed into the Google Old Speckled Hen, and one of the second things that came up was clone. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe there are other beers that taste like it. But no, in the spirit of doing it yourself, there are apparently lots and lots of forums out there for home brewers who to make their own clone of Old Speckled Hen. Not one I am familiar with, but bitter doesn't bother me too much if it's, you know, like I don't like the bitterness in like an IPA, but I do like the bitterness in like a Guinness. So if it's like that darker, like kind of the malty roasted bitter, I think it'd be right up my alley.
Yeah, I don't know exactly the flavor profile of Old Speckled Hen, but I like stouts, and I also like pale ale. So either way, I imagine I would enjoy it, but not enough to go 100 miles.
Maybe 50 miles, but 100 miles too far.
Yeah. So thank you, Howie, for leaving us a voice message. And those are very interesting items that we certainly like to talk about those things.
Yeah, absolutely. So getting into here, I've got a whole handful of notes in here. I don't know that we can get through all of them. Are there any on here that look like they are interest to you that you want to talk about?
Well, certainly the topical one is the Google Doc scam. That was almost too effective. It infiltrated a computer so quickly, I think, that it got too much attention and got shut down.
Oh, right away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's interesting. I'm a heavily invested in the Google ecosystem. A lot of people that I know are. And I don't know that I actually received any of the phishing emails. Yeah. And I do know some less technically savvy people who use Google products. And I was just bracing myself, figuring I was going to get it from somebody. And before Google got it locked down, I really didn't. So apparently, I guess last week, depending on when you're listening to it, last week for us, you may have gotten an email inviting you to share a Google Doc. And if you clicked on it, it would, I guess, send out like links to everybody on your contact list. It took you to a real Google hosted page with a list of your Google accounts, and when you selected the account, it would attempt, I guess, to load an app called Google Docs. Somehow somebody managed to slip a third-party app called Google Docs in. It would ask for account permissions, and why wouldn't you? It says Google Docs right there in the app name, and when you click the Allow button, the not actually Google Docs app would have your permission to read emails and contacts, and it would immediately start blasting to your entire list. So I guess, yeah, Google found it, shut it down pretty quickly. They, I think within 36, 48 hours had pretty much had this buttoned up and had it shut down. But in the meantime, lots and lots of people, fell for it. I did see one article that talked about, checking to see if you had been hit. Now I have not seen if Google has gone and, proactively done this, but, if you go into your Google account app permissions, which you, if you click on your, little picture icon when you're logged into like Gmail or something like that, you can go into like My Account, and then you can go in to see what permissions applications have. And if you have one called Google Docs in that list, you then you probably need to go and remove it. That is not the one that should be there. Apparently, if you do use Google's Docs, it has access to your account by default and does not show up as an approved app. Those are all, I guess, third-party apps that you have granted access. So go in and scrub them away.
Yeah, I think I read that it went through a lot of media companies.
I can see that, sure.
But I think BuzzFeed was on the list, and I'm trying to remember some of the other ones. And, of course, Google has now come out and said that they've got some more phishing protections in. So hopefully, to give some credit, this was a very well thought out scam.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, even people that are used to being aware might have clicked on this because it looked legit.
Well, yeah, and it takes you to the Google account page. That looks legitimate. You see an app called Google Docs that is requesting access, and you're like, well, okay, maybe it lost permission. I'll give it permission. It's Google. And then once it gets in, it gotcha. I was looking to see if there were any numbers that had been put out on the number of people that might have been affected, and I'm not seeing anything at a quick glance. But yeah, I mean, you've got to wonder if people could put that sort of conniving and scheming to good, as opposed to,
right,
you know, doing something not good. Like, what? How much better could the world be? This is why we can't have nice things.
Right. And I read an article kind of related to this by Jerry Hildebrand at Android Central, and the factoid that I picked out of it is you're going to probably have more malware written for Android because worldwide, it's on about 70% of phones.
Sure.
So even though in the U.S., you know, Apple has the most market share, if you're going for the biggest population to scam, Android is where it's at globally.
Well, and, you know, not having used Android recently, I can't speak to this, so maybe you can. But I know that back when I was on Android, which would have been ice cream sandwich, jelly bean Kit Kat era. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's like, what, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, something like that. The app permissions when you installed an app were a mess. Like, it would pop
right
up when you installed something. And it would just be this huge list of, I need access to SMS and
absolutely
your phone and your email and this and this and this. And you'd look at this list, you'd be like, why does it need access to that stuff? And then your only choice was allow or deny.
Right.
You couldn't, there was no granularity. There was no explanation of why does this app, which should, it's a game, why does it need SMS? But for some reason, maybe it legitimately did. And so, you know, it was a little bit of a gamble of, I'd look at the Play Store and, okay, well, it's got like 4 million downloads. It's probably mm-hmm legit. I guess I'll click okay. But you never were 100% sure. I mean, has Android gotten better and more granular and clean that mess up?
It's better now. So let's assume that you're on Nougat, which about, 1.5% of Android devices will, actually, I think it's maybe up to 7% with the Galaxy S8 shipping. But point being, if you're on an Android, I know Nougat, maybe even Marshmallow, what you kind of do is, as you use that feature, the first time you use that feature mm-hmm in that app is when you get notified. So it's the reason that that's better is you're doing something in the app and it says, oh, this app now needs to access your contacts. Will you allow it?
Okay.
So it's more of a one-off thing the first time. It doesn't ask you every time.
Right.
But the first time you have that app use that, you say allow. Or you can say deny and it'll just take you back to the previous screen. So it's better now if you're on the latest operating system.
Yeah, and that's the way that iOS has done it for a while, where it'll pop up and say, I want access to your camera, I want access to GPS, I want access to your microphone, and you can, it doesn't just bombard you all at once. Well, some apps do, and I don't appreciate those apps. The developers need to think that through, and instead of throwing 5 different approve this buttons at me, but yeah, that makes a lot more sense than the way they used to do it.
Yeah.
And you're right, just over 7%, actually, according to Google's developer portal, or Android's developer portal.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like 7.0 and 7.1 combined are 7.1%. It looks like Android has gotten a lot better at bringing people out of the dark ages, although they still have 1% sitting there on Gingerbread.
Yeah, which is no longer supported anymore.
Surprisingly, more than they have on ice cream sandwich, at 0.8%.
I know it's all over. I think I looked at that recently. Kit Kat may have the largest share still.
15% does now.
Lollipop,
so it looks
okay.
Like Jelly Bean has a combined about 9%.
Okay.
Kit Kat's at 18.8. Lollipop is between the two releases. 20 or 30
point
something percent. Marshmallow is at 31.2%, and then Nougat's at 7.1.
And Lollipop would have come out at the end of 2014 and been on most phones by, say, the middle of 2015.
Yeah, and this does not show release date windows, just just the platform versions and distributions. But, I mean, still, that's one thing that I don't know what the solution is. I don't know if Google has a plan, but that fracturing and lack of support among some of the budget manufacturers, that's got to be a bad thing long term, I think, for Android.
I agree. And, of course, if it's a tablet connected to the Play Store, those things don't get updated.
No, not at all.
Unless it's a Google Pixel tablet or Google Nexus tablet, they're not going to get an update.
Samsung updating their tablets, or do they just crank them out and that's it?
I shouldn't say no for sure, but I don't believe that they are. Samsung isn't that great on updates. Just last week, I think, the S7, last year's model, got the final Nougat releases.
Really?
And yeah, for the, I forget which carrier it was, but and Unlocked as well was really lagging behind. So it Samsung is not that great on getting updates to its devices, even some of its newer ones.
I would have assumed that, you know, they would be more of a flagship tablet maker, and that that would be, if you're going to see updates, it would be on the flagship products as opposed to, you know, some Chinese special that you got for, you know, $20 off of eBay or something or other.
Yeah, it's like you said, it is an issue. And I think Mr. Hildebrand that we heard from a couple episodes ago agreed that the update thing for Android is a mess. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, it just varies from manufacturer to manufacturer and carrier to carrier.
So, you know, interesting. I did find an app recently that tend to be iOS centric, but this one is both for iOS and Android. So I'll segue into this. This is an app that you need to check out if you have not already. It is called Tunity, T-U-N-I-T-Y. Okay. And it's magic. Like, it is dark voodoo magic. So the premise behind it is you are out in a bar, a pub, if you will, having a pint with your mates. And having some bitters. And there is a soccer match up on the TV, and you want to see if Manchester United is beating Wimbledon's, I don't know, playing the round ball. So it's loud, and they have the TV muted. You whip out your mobile device, you launch this app, you take a picture of the TV screen, and as long as it is on one of the roughly 100 or so channels that they support, from that one picture that it takes, it syncs up and then streams the audio live to your device.
Wow.
And it works really, really well. So when I first read about this, I'm like, oh, go on, that can't possibly work. And I was at work, so I didn't have TVs around me and whatnot, but I was able to pull up CNN's live stream. And sure enough, it identified it and pulled up CNN. And there was a little bit of a lag, but inside of the app, you can actually adjust the latency. So if you're watching something on cable versus satellite versus aerial, and you're across the room and there's some lag, you can say, well, slow it down, speed it up. Now, it looked like on some of the stuff like pool feeds, it would sometimes confuse what it was showing me. So a few times when I was scanning CNN to test it, it came up CNN most times, but it came up Fox News a couple times, and they were showing an AP pool feed of the president speaking. But I was out that very night that I had found this app with my family having dinner, and we were at a pizzeria that had multiple TVs all around the place, and I tried it on a handful of TVs, and it worked a trick. It would identify the channel, and it takes 30 or 40 seconds, and then it would start streaming the audio. And the thing that I found amazing is I'm in a restaurant taking pictures of a TV all the way across the room. So on the screen itself, it's only taken up 10-15% of what the camera's. It's not like you got to zoom in on it, and it does its little analyzing, and then it figures out, oh, I think this is, you know, Fox Sports Midwest, and boom, it starts streaming the audio. It was stunning how well it worked. The app itself is free. I didn't see any options to do in-app purchases. It looks like, I'm really not sure how they're monetizing it. They do show like a Twitter feed type deal inside the app, and I don't know if that's actually Twitter or if that is a Tunity feed, but it looks like maybe they would slip ads into that. But yeah, it's a really, really neat app. If you frequently find yourself out in places and need to hear what's going on the TVs around you, I would give it a look. I totally could see, I don't know, maybe a traveling consultant who hosts a podcast and he's out having dinner by himself and wants to hear what's on the TV in the restaurant. You could just snap it and sit there and listen with the headphones on. It's a really, really cool app.
Yet another reason for me to have my headphones on me at all times.
There you go. Absolutely.
I usually have at least one pair with me, but I don't like to wear the on-ears all the time, only if I have a specific goal in mind. Otherwise, I like just the little buds. Like buds. Today when I went to Meijer, I just put the earbuds in, and it's not quite as antisocial, I don't think, as the big over-the-ear ones. But I will wear those in a pinch.
Well, you know, I like the earbuds just because they don't completely block out the outside world.
Right.
And, there have been times when I'm out and, people do interact with you. And even with headphones in, like, apparently that is no longer the universal sign of don't talk to me. That
no.
is just the universal sign of talk loudly to me. And
yeah.
And it is easier to hear if I have my earbuds in, as opposed to, I have a big pair of Bluetooth over the ear DJ cans that I'll sometimes wear at my desk. But they're not so good for the portable stuff.
Looks like it's only got about 6,400 downloads in the Google App Store, Tunity. So, hey, you still get it on the ground floor on this one.
There you go. I do like that. I do miss that from the Google Play Store. I like that it would show you how many downloads. I don't think there's an equivalent in the Apple world. I don't know if it's a new company and they're just starting to get their name out there or what, but maybe it doesn't work as well on Android. I haven't tried it over there. It works like a champ on iOS. Really, really cool. I don't know. It might be spying on me all the time. Like, it may be a terrible app to have on my phone, but it's really cool. So that's my little tip there.
Yeah, I saw this other note here on the list that Steve Ballmer is chasing government money. What's he doing? Yeah.
So this is a really, really interesting thing that he's doing. And after I had put the notes in the show notes, I actually heard an interview with him on, I think it was Marketplace on NPR. I could be wrong. I know I heard him on NPR, but I don't remember which show it's on. Basically, now that he is retired and has, 15, $20 billion dollars? I mean, it's much more than I have. he has decided that following the money that the government spends and that it brings in is the best way to keep everybody honest, basically.
Right.
So he has...
Sunlight.
That's right. So he has created this, nonprofit, this organization. It's called USA Facts, and their website is usafacts.org. It's beautifully designed. They worked with a well-known design company for architecting the site. So navigating it is just gorgeous. And at the very high level, it shows you where all of the money comes from, and you can drill all the way back to you've got tax revenue, and then what makes up the tax revenue: individual incomes, property taxes, corporate income taxes, licenses, blah blah blah. And you can drill in where all of the revenue sources come from, and then you can look at spending at a very high level, looking federally. And I think their data is 2014, 2015. I don't know that they've got it newer than that yet. So it shows total revenue in 2014 was $5.2 trillion. Total spending was $5.4 trillion. So the astute among us might notice that there is a small discrepancy there. So you can drill into spending, but you can also query and he's going to give better examples, and the examples I heard in the interview are going to be way better than anything I'm going to come up with on the fly. But they've built basically a search engine where you can drill in and ask questions. It's sort of a Google for federal spending and policy wonks, where you can go in and you can say, show me bankruptcies in 2012. And if I do that, bankruptcies 2012, it comes up and it shows, here's a graph. There were 1.2 million bankruptcies filed in 2012 and 1.3 million bankruptcies terminated. And you can actually click on those and see the data. And it looks like they have data going back from 1980 all the way up to 2015. And you can see So the goal is to really sort of make all of this data visible, put it out there so that everybody can see it, make it so that it's numbers, it's facts. It's not something that you can argue about because, my policy. I may believe that this policy is going to help people, and somebody else may believe it's the worst policy ever, and vice versa. It's kind of hard to argue with. We brought this much money in, we spent this much money, and here's where it went. They're trying to really gear it towards decision makers, they say, at all levels. They're, you know, gunning for the armchair policy wonks. They only use nonpartisan numbers provided by government agencies for consistencies. They don't use any forecasts that any of the agencies produce or deal in. The company that helped them design it is a Seattle-based design firm called Artifact. So he has given a boatload of money, relatively speaking, for this. Apparently, he has invested around $10 million so far, and has committed to spending several million dollars a year to keep the service and the site up and running. They've got a team of researchers and data analyst experts who basically comb through all this data and put it together and quantify it and put it into their giant search engine. So if you are someone interested in where the money comes from, where it goes, how it's being used, or you just like beautiful visual design of complex data, check out this usafacts.org. It's a really, really interesting website. And apparently one of the things that billionaire Steve Ballmer is doing in his retirement, you know, outside of being a billionaire and owning, who is it, the Seahawks, or who did he buy? He bought one of those sports ball teams. I don't remember which one. Oh, it was the baseball. It was the Roger Sterling, whatever team that was.
Roger Sterling? Not sure.
Yeah, I don't remember. It was scandal a few years ago. And he just came in and wrote a check for it. That'd be nice to be able to do. So, yeah, it's kind of cool.
I like this idea a lot. I know that even the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, mm-hmm. has struggled with where all the spending has been going and the revenue sources. So to have that in one site, if we can get enough journalists and, like you said, Congress critters looking at it, aware of it, should help guide some policy and get a better idea of, wow, you know, didn't realize we were spending that much money on that particular type of program, or, hey, it looks like this program is duplicated across 97 different agencies. You know, maybe we could consolidate that into 96 or something.
Yeah.
So,
and I don't know at a high level, you know, what sort of policies or politics Steve Ballmer is known for. I mean, I don't know if he leans left or leans right. I'm assuming, you know, a middle-aged white billionaire, you can sort of make some assumptions on his political leanings. So, you know, the sad thing is, I would hope that those inherent biases don't get thrown about. Well, you can't trust that because he's obviously a rabid conservative or a flaming liberal or whatnot. You know, I think that, you know, that is something to be aware of, that, you know, anybody's who's got an agenda is going to, you know, do whatever they can to spin it in their favor.
But if it's black and white numbers from government agencies, then that charge of bias is usually less stinging. So
an intelligent person would assume that, but not everybody is as intelligent and as objective as you
very
might be.
Very little in the political discussion fits that the narrative of of objective. How about that?
Yeah. Okay. There you go. I mean, subjective is so much nicer because you can set up things to support your worldview. You know, like one of the examples that their actual site gives you, because it looks like they scroll past some little examples, you know, like they look at under promoting the general welfare, you know, you can find data on life expectancy and what's supporting that and programs that go into increasing life expectancy, poverty rate of all persons, which apparently is sitting at 15% as of 2014. But interestingly, if you go back to 1980, it was at 13%. It's been trending up in the last handful of years, but it's still, you know, pretty stable. And I guess you can drill into it and find all of the data that comes into what makes up that poverty rate and programs that, you know, it's all supposed to be there. I've not really played with the site that much, but it's pretty cool.
Instead of going on a political rant about poverty rates, I would like to talk about something that you've had in the notes for a while here. Intel's first Optane SSD?
Yeah.
375 gigabytes that you can use as RAM? I want to hear about this.
So I don't even remember now the episode that we talked about it on, but I remember Jeff talking last year about 3D crosspoint technology. He had been he had found an article that talked a little bit about it, and had heard on another tech podcast some early talkings about this new technology, 3D crosspoint, which was better in every conceivable way, apparently. So Intel, and this is a little bit old news now, they have a limited availability commercial product. Apparently, it's still kind of hard to get your hands on them, but it is a product that is using this 3D crosspoint technology, and they are calling it Optane. That is the brand name. So they have a new solid-state hard drive. It's called the DCP4800X. It's a 375 gigabyte SSD solid-state hard drive on a PCIe card, and it's really not crazy expensive. I mean, it's a lot of money, limited availability, but you can pick one up if you can find one for $1,520. They say that it will be broadly available the second half of this year, and in the second quarter, so potentially any day now, they're going to be releasing a 750 gigabyte version as well, and they're also going to be releasing this 375 gigabyte version in a U.2 form factor, which I have to do some research on. I'm not that familiar with that form factor. I'm assuming it's a smaller form factor to fit probably into smaller servers and whatnot. They also plan later this year, in the second half of this year, to have a 1.5 terabyte card in the PCIe form factor, and a 750 gigabyte and 1.5 terabyte U2 stick as well. So what makes this really interesting is they are saying that this is 1,000 times faster than NAND flash and 10 times denser than DRAM. And it also has upwards of 1,000 times more endurance than the NAND storage, so that you don't have to worry as much about the write exhaustion where you do with, like if you take a thumb drive and just bash it and let it write over and over and over again, eventually you'll exhaust the NAND memory. So the really cool thing is it will also, you can use it as storage or you can use it as RAM. And it's not quite as fast as DRAM, but it's almost. And if you are dealing in applications where you need huge, huge data basically held in memory, like say with a database or with a big data analysis tool, this is really a cheap way to get yourself a giant amount of RAM. I know where I work, we just put in some new servers a few months ago, and they have 512 gigabytes of RAM. And these frickin' servers individually cost as much as a house. And
that's
almost
a lot of RAM.
Yeah, and almost all of the money is RAM. So this is like $1,500, and it's almost as much memory as in these servers. And I think the sticker on these servers was pushing $180,000. and a big, big chunk of it. I don't remember the specific details, but a big chunk of that money was the 512 gigabytes of RAM. So it has sequential transfer rates that are really high. So Intel published these specs back in February, I suppose they didn't publish them. They leaked back in February. Obviously, this is they're saying it's data center oriented piece of hardware. So it's built for really high read loads, especially. So sequential transfer rates of around 2,400 megabytes per second, which is just insane. So 2.4 gigabytes per second read speeds, and around 2 gigabytes per second write speeds. So ahead of what NAND can do, and it can also sustain these high I/O loads. because of the 3D crosspoint technology. They were saying in the article, and this is starting to get into the weeds of stuff where even I'm like, what the heck does all this mean? So with your standard thumb drive, what you're putting in, you know, your NAND flash, it's page addressed, which means that when you want to read data off of that, you have to go to a page, read that page, and then find the specific data that you're looking for, bring it in, and then throw the rest of the stuff that you don't care about away. And that takes time. But this 3D crosspoint stuff is byte addressable. So each individual byte can be read and written. So normally, this reading and writing takes place at the page granularity, and for reading, it's not as much of a problem. For writing, you basically have to buffer a whole page and then write it all at one time. And with 3D crosspoint, you can do it a byte at a time. So, you can very quickly update. You don't have to hold things in memory and flush them to pages. It physically doesn't wear the media nearly as much as with traditional flash. So the writes are what they call non-destructive. So it has incredible endurance compared to standard NAND storage. They're saying that these Optane solid-state drives can be safely written to 30 times per day compared with a typical 0.5 to 10 whole drive writes per day with current solid-state technology. So,
so they're saying like the entire drive can be written over. My goodness.
Yeah, up to 30 times per day, and you won't see any destruction of you won't see wear of the actual memory cells, whereas you will see wear in a solid-state drive. So when you go out and buy a solid-state drive, and you buy a 128-gigabyte drive, it has more than 128 gigabytes of storage on it. Not a lot more, but it has more, and part of the reason for that is as you are using it and writing to those memory cells, they wear out over time. And part of the memory mapper that's built into the drive, it identifies when cells are wearing out and are no longer reliable, and then it will remap those to other parts of the drive. And so that it's kind of like that little bit extra in your gas tank. Yeah, it says it's empty, but you can still go another 20 miles down the road to the gas station. Same idea. And it does that so that it gives you, it can spread that wear around and you still get the 128 gigabytes. And then there's all sorts of technologies to, you know, randomize write so that you're not hitting the same memory cells over and over again. And almost all of those problems are alleviated with this 3D crosspoint technology. There were some other things that I didn't put in here because it started to get really deep into the weeds of like high level or, you know, details that only a very small number of people would care about. But they said one of the things that makes this technology so special is the ability to maintain these speeds even as your queues increase. And like I said, I'm way out of my element in talking about this specifically, but the example they gave was that with a standard SSD, as this queue length increases, your performance just falls off a cliff. It's like an inverse logarithmically connected relationship. So as the queue length goes up, it's just falling towards infinitely poor performance. And that doesn't exist with this crosspoint technology. So even as your queue length increases, your performance just, yeah, it'll fall off, but it falls off in a much more or much less linear fashion. So apparently there's a lot of excitement around these. And then the thing that really makes people excited about these is they have developed a middleware layer that boots into the computer before the OS boots up, and transparent to the operating system can reconfigure one of these devices to look like just standard RAM. So you can have a large pool of volatile memory. So like I said, it's not as fast, but it's cheap and can be good enough for a lot of things. And the example that they give is that a 2-socket Xeon system can hold around 3 terabytes of RAM physically, but you can put 24 terabytes of this Optane product in it, and a 4-socket system can support 12 terabytes of RAM, but 48 terabytes of Optane storage. So, again, if you're doing big data analysis, if you've got a giant database that you need to hold in memory,
yeah.
I mean, this could be like a game changer for you.
This could be like the recommended install for SAP systems. Like, you know, I could just see that, or whatever big databases need to do all those calculations on the fly.
Now,
I just checked. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say what'll be interesting is to see if enterprises adopt this, or if this is really a product that ends up getting gobbled up by the big cloud providers, because, you know, one of the things that their clients want is, you know, memory, and memory, you know, it's hard to put memory and the densities into machines that users want and still make it affordable on a, you know, a resource allocation level. I'm curious if this will skip over the enterprise and go more to cloud computing, because, I mean, our organization's even looking at cloud for why build the infrastructure when we can let someone else build the infrastructure and we'll just sit on their infrastructure. So I don't know.
I looked over here at Amazon and Newegg, and the only thing that they have available right now is the 16 gigabyte module, which is a very reasonable $49.
Right.
The 32 gig, which is not in stock at either place, is $79. So they obviously haven't quite rolled it out here as we record this in the early May, but it would be interesting. I'm trying to think. Yeah, so in theory, you could build a system basically without RAM, with just a big sort of SSD, or either you could have the SSD and then also your kind of standard hard drive if you wanted more storage.
Yeah, I mean, for certain applications, for, you know, the home gamer, probably not. Because as I recall from the conversation we had way back when, one of the things that Jeff was talking about that's really exciting about this is it has a lot of advantages over flash storage, and it can double as both RAM and storage. But it doesn't do the RAM as well. So it was geared more towards, like, for Internet of Things devices. You just give it a little bit of this cross-point storage, and it can double as both storage for data capture as well as memory to run an OS on some Internet of Things thing out there. And the performance isn't something that you probably are all that worried about if it's your thermostat that is collecting data points and running a little embedded operating system, or, you know, whatever, you know, your refrigerator. I mean, they put internet in everything now, your light bulbs. But it certainly could be fine for, you know, building a PC potentially. Maybe it wouldn't be as much of a performance, but if you had the need to have a huge amount of RAM for something, I mean, you can't touch it. I mean, it's the price that you're going to pay, you're going to sacrifice a little bit of performance. But usually if you need to hold 20 terabytes of memory in, you know, of data in memory, the speed, it's faster than you can put on SAN, spinning disk. I mean, it's going to be a lot faster. I mean, you're going to get huge gains over having it on disk. So, yeah, I don't know where they're going to go with that. And it actually segues me into one that I wanted to touch on quickly, because I did not know about this. I just saw this this article, and I had kind of, in the back of my mind, went, huh, I didn't know they even did that. So IBM is launching 4 new data centers in the United States.
Okay.
They apparently have been putting a lot of emphasis on their cloud services. Everybody has, and they have just announced they are opening 4 new data centers in the United States, 2 in Dallas, and 2 in Washington, D.C. This is the part where I started to kind of scratch my head and go, really, IBM? It brings their total number of data centers for their cloud services to 55, 22 in the United States alone. And they noted in their quarterly earnings report released in April that revenue from cloud services was up 33% in the last quarter, with their total cloud revenue hitting $14.6 billion over the last 12 months. I don't think of IBM when I think of cloud. I mean, I think of Amazon, I think of Google, I think of Microsoft, I think of Oracle, but they are a huge player in the cloud space. Apparently the revenue from their cloud businesses is substantial compared to a lot of their other business units. They're seeing shrinking and stagnation in some of their other business units, and they're having growth in cloud. Everybody who's doing cloud is having growth in cloud. They're expected to open 4 additional data centers in the first half of 2017 on top of the 4 that have already opened. So that'd be a total of 8 in 2017 that are announced so far. Apparently, they are focusing on an emphasis on bare metal servers. So basically, it's like you're getting a machine in the cloud. They're not giving you a nice pre-built operating system or pre-packaged application that you can just install your software into or start running. They're giving you a virtual box, and you have to configure it and put an operating system on it and, you know, boot it from the ground up, what a lot of the providers are calling infrastructure as a service. So apparently that's what they're kind of focusing on or specializing in. And they are apparently doing a lot with the NVIDIA GPUs. So you can build high-performance computing applications within their cloud. You can use, leverage a lot of their machine learning models. They have also created a platform called Bluemix, which lets them operate one of the largest OpenStack clouds. And they've got a new open source project called OpenWhisk, which is basically going towards this what's called serverless computing. I'm familiar with OpenStack, which is sort of I want to run my own cloud, and OpenStack is the sort of secret sauce that makes it happen, where you install it on a bunch of commodity equipment and it virtualizes it into, you know, more, it basically combines the CPU resources, the RAM resources, the disk resources, and lets you, you know, kind of have your own cloud. And OpenWhisk, it gets really kind of out there. I was trying to do a little bit of reading on it, but the whole idea is that it's just business rules that fire off, and there's no server in between. It's messages that have rules and actions, and when something sends a message on one piece, it hits a rules engine and triggers all sorts of different things, and other things happen, and then you get a result. And so it's like serverless applications, which I can't even get my head around.
Well, I wouldn't have guessed this up front, but hearing about it doesn't surprise me. The main reason is IBM still has a very good reputation with businesses.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
As an IT person, if you want to go to a cloud solution or you want to do something that's a little different, if you can go to the higher ups and tell them, oh, but IBM is hosting this, then they feel better about the security factor, the trust that it's going to be good. So I think they're probably leveraging that well-earned reputation over the years to do this, but I didn't realize it was this big.
No, I didn't either. And I mean, you know, IBM is definitely investing a lot in R&D that the general public never really hears about. I mean, mm-hmm. They do a lot with machine learning. Obviously, they've built Watson. You know, it not only won at Jeopardy, but they're leveraging Watson for, you know, in the medical fields and investing and all sorts of applications that machines can analyze huge data sets and try and find and draw conclusions there. And I mean, IBM's doing a lot of that, and the average person doesn't really hear a lot about it. So, I don't know. I did not know that IBM was that big in the cloud space. I'm going to have to kind of put them back on my radar as one to watch, because that's not one that I even think about usually when I think about cloud computing.
Yeah. Hey, I didn't put this in the notes, but I saw that Apple had hired ex-NASA and Tesla staffers to boost its self-driving car effort. And we talked about Apple, the kind of the rumors surrounding that, but they're saying that it's codenamed Project Titan. Have you read about this at all?
Yeah, there was some rumblings last year about Project Titan, and there's kind of a big debate on whether Apple is actually building a car or whether Apple is building a platform to show to the other auto manufacturers, this is how you should build a car, and let us be your technology partner. You guys go build all of the mechanicals, and we'll come in behind and integrate the systems because we do that well. And Apple doesn't say anything about business that they haven't announced yet, so nobody really knows.
Yeah, this was because they had to file something with the state of California.
Right.
And in March, the California authorities issued a permit to Apple, and apparently, even though the names were supposed to be redacted, they weren't, and Business Insider and Wall Street Journal both got a hold of it and published this ex-Tesla, trying to find the names here, Shilpa Gulati, I'm sure I mispronounced that, yeah, an experienced roboticist, and he says, or it says, it could be a he or a she, I don't know, working on special projects at a Silicon Valley company. Sorry, it is a she. So Apple is not named, but they think, you know, the speculation is that from this permit that they got issued, they're planning to have a driver sit in the car, but the car is supposed to be autonomous. So we'll see. But apparently the rumors that had said that the program had been scaled back are not correct.
Well, that's interesting. And I think I want to say that last year, and I might have this wrong, but I thought that there was a bit of a scuttle that a handful of well-known former Tesla employees and people connected with other auto manufacturing who had joined Apple had left Apple. And but I don't remember specifically. Here's a headline. I don't see the date on this. Apple electric car project boss leaving company. Here's another one. Apple car boss. What's the date on this? Oh, my computer just wants to be slow. Don't you just love technology? Apple director leaves company. Former Aston Martin engineering leaves Tesla to join Apple. So, I mean, they've had a lot of people coming and going. This Apple car director leaving was dated January of last year in 2016. That's Steve Jadesky. Would probably be something that that Jeff would know a lot more about. We should probably...
That's right. Make he's going to sure listen to this and yeah, come through
to have
the
him comment on it. So what I don't
are you guys
know...
talking about? You're messing it all up.
Well, and you know, I still don't know that I understand the benefits behind Apple being a car company as well, but maybe I there seems to be an awful lot of room for, you know, people willing to spend $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 on a luxury sedan, and you've got to assume that if Apple's going to get into that space, it's probably going to be higher end, just like all of their other products
right.
are. For, you know, whether that whether it's truly a higher end product or not, they definitely have that cachet, and I think they're still one of the best rated, if not the best rated or best trusted brand on the planet. And I heard a little thing last week that Apple's cash reserves are at an all-time high.
Yes.
$256.8 billion. Most of it, I guess, is money that would have to be repatriated. So it is outside of the country. But still, they have more than $250 billion, more than a quarter of a trillion dollars in cash. And that's the crazy part to me. That's not just like, oh, our assets. That's cash. I mean,
that's part of the issue, right? Investors want to know, what are you doing with all that cash? Where are you going to employ it to get growth and throw off income? Because investors want income and sales growth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's the point of stockpiling it? Either give it mm-hmm. back in the form of dividends, and I know that there are some pretty aggressive, who is it? Is it, I think, Icon, who has pushed hard for Apple to pay dividends, and under Tim Cook, Apple has paid record dividends for the company. They never did that under, well, they did it in a very limited fashion under Steve right. Jobs, but they have returned money to shareholders. But yeah, what else do they need to be sitting on that kind of money for? Just to say they have the biggest pile of cash? I mean, that's not a good thing.
Well, hopefully we'll get more news, and hopefully the Apple Car will be as successful as the watch and phone and iPad. My wife and I were just talking today. We think we're going to get one of the new iPads because it's the best tablet out there.
Yeah, and you'll get updates.
And we'll get updates. And that is, you know, I've talked about the, you know, my son's got my old iPhone 4 that is just about done. So that's another option. He, I guess, is more interested in a tablet. So we're looking at that. And as much as I would love to say, oh, no, we should buy an Android tablet, the Tab S3 looks interesting from Samsung, but there aren't a lot of good ones out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll bring you over to the dark side yet. We'll get an iPhone 8 into your hands.
Grubby little hands.
It'll happen.
Speaking of Android.
Yeah, you have a couple on here that I was curious about.
Yeah, the main thing that I wanted to go through was, obviously we're in Samsung flagship release season, mm-hmm. and the S8 is getting great reviews, even though there's a few quirks about it. We talked about that phone. This one came out about a month ago, and I don't want to pass people by because it's a really nice product. And the Android Central article lists it as the new standard for budget phones, the Moto G5 Plus.
Okay.
So this is a Lenovo / Motorola product. And the specs on this are a little bit different. It has Nougat, which is nice. Ships with Nougat. It's a 5.2-inch 1080p display with a Snapdragon 625 processor. And what that, so that's not, it's a lower end processor, but what it's great at is power usage. So you're going to get a ton of battery life with the Snapdragon 625 as opposed to the 800 series that are in all your high end phones.
Right.
You can get this phone in configurations of either 32 or 64 gigabytes of storage. The 32 gigabyte would have 2 gigs of RAM, and the 64 gigabyte storage has 4 gigs of RAM. It does have the micro SD expandable port up to 128 gigs, and it's got a 12 megapixel rear camera with a 3000 milliamp battery. Now, this is a budget phone, so there are some compromises. The number one for me, and the reason that I probably could not buy this, lacks NFC in the United States.
So it has NFC, just not here.
Not in the U.S. It has it. It's in their international model, it has it. And what we talked about earlier in the show, right? There's just not that much demand for it here. Because only a couple places out of 10 that you visit will take contactless payments. So while that feature is important to me because I like to use Android Pay wherever I possibly can.
Right.
It's not going to have it in the phone. It also has a micro USB port instead of the new USB 3.0, which is kind of a bummer. But
that's
it
not
does
really
have faster.
A deal breaker, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, I don't know. I've got at least 5 cords around here probably that does micro USB. So that would not be a big deal if I were to pick that up and just plug it in upstairs, downstairs, whatever.
Yeah. And it's 5.2 inches, which that's pretty big as far as budget mm-hmm. phones go. You don't usually see the bigger screen size and budget in the same breath.
Well, yes and no, though. You got to remember we're into a world now where the small S8 is a 5.9 inch display.
Okay.
It's really tall.
Right,
and,
right.
And so this is the older 16:9 configuration. The camera also is just meh in low light. It has, yeah. I think it has a pretty good sensor, but you're going to be fine probably in daylight, which is good, but it's not going to be that great in low light. Let's see. And then the most important thing, though, is the price.
Okay, yeah.
You can get it for $230 unlocked in the 32 gigabyte configuration, or $300 will get you that 64 gigabyte and 4 gigs of RAM, which is what I would recommend. 2 gigs of RAM a year in is probably going to get pretty sluggish, so I would definitely get the extra $70 for the $300. And I'm pretty sure you can get the Amazon ads. So if you really wanted to buy this through Amazon and have some ads on your screen, you could probably get it for what, $250? $260, something like that. It also, you still get the trademark Moto gestures to launch the camera, which is the double twist, I believe.
Oh,
and
right.
Double chop will turn on the flashlight automatically. So, really nice phone that is not going to break the bank. So, if you want to play with an Android phone, or if you want to get one for your kid, this is a really good option. Because if I buy it for my kid, he doesn't have any money to pay with anything. I don't care if he has NFC.
Yeah, and he can just stare at those Amazon ads. That'll net you $60 off of the 64 gig model.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I want him staring at ads. That'll give him other things that he wants to buy.
So how does that work? If you buy one of these phones that Amazon has partnered with that has the lock screen ads, it's not running Amazon's Fire OS, which is their build of Android. How do they enforce that and keep me from doing something to take the ads off of it? Because this little blurb just says you agree to lock screen ads and a few pre-installed apps. Can I not just root it and take that right off of there?
It's got some extra security. I think it would be trickier to root than a standard phone, but I don't know. I haven't looked. It's possible there are some options available out in the community, but I don't know if you would run into trouble or if they check it every once in a while when you log in to make sure that you're still, seeing the ads display. Not 100% sure.
You know, and it's probably like all things, even they probably just figured, you know what, a percentage of people are going to do it. And that percentage is probably less than 3. I mean, it's going to be a tiny, tiny percentage.
Exactly.
And they're just like, that's the cost of doing business, because 99% of people aren't going to screw with this, and we'll show them the ads. And to be fair, I have ads on my Kindle, both on my traditional e-reader, and I have a Kindle Fire. And there have been times when an ad has popped up that's relevant that I've bought a book, or I've, if you buy a gift card through this, you get a $25 gift card and they'll give you an extra $5. Okay, sold. I'll give you 25 for 30 all day long.
Yeah. For as much as my libertarian instincts, squeam a little bit about sharing data, I like targeted ads.
Right.
I like getting ads that are relevant to me and seeing those, so I'm generally okay with it.
Yeah, and it looks like doing a Google of remove Amazon ads from Moto G5 turns up a handful of results, and here's a CNET article with the headline. Where did it go? I just lost the darn thing. What's the Moto G4 like with Amazon ads? Not bad at all. So, I mean, they come to the quick conclusion that it's not that annoying. And to be fair, it's not that annoying on like the Amazon Fire. I mean, it's there when you unlock the device, and that's really about the only time that it bugs you. So interesting.
Good deal. Yeah, and the fact that it has some pre-installed apps will tell me a phone that doesn't. I mean, I think I mentioned I saw my dad's S8 on Verizon, and it had all kinds bloatware on it. So.
Well, and depending on what apps they are, it might be apps that I'm going to download and put on, because I have the Kindle app on my iPhone. I have the Amazon app on my iPhone. I have the Amazon Music app on my iPhone. I mean, if you put those on there for me, you just saved me 5 minutes.
Exactly.
Again, I think it depends on whether you're in Amazon's ecosystem or not, and I am, so no problems there at all. Very cool.
All right, we've been going for a while. Should we wrap up?
Yeah, I think we should. Let me jump down here. Todd, what is it that you are in love with this week?
So this is one of those things, the old song, don't know what you got till it's gone, right? My beautiful Logitech G35 headset broke. And I don't want to, you know, cast any aspersions without evidence, but it does get a lot of wear, not by me, by certain 10 and soon to be 8-year-olds that like to spin around in the chair and twist the wires and the cords. Anyway, I picked up a Razer headset at Walmart on clearance to give it a shot.
Okay.
And discovered there was a reason that it was on clearance. It sounds fine and it's comfortable, but the microphone, not that great. Now, to be fair, it's got the analog line-in mic set up as opposed to USB, so maybe it's something wrong with my motherboard.
Okay.
But anyway, I ordered another Logitech G35, and I've been using it. You can wear it, or at least I can wear it for hours. Very comfortable. The microphone sounds good. I don't have any problems with people hearing me on TeamSpeak or Ventrilo or whatever. And it's just really nice. It is expensive. It's about $135 is what I paid for it. But for years and hours of wear, I deem that a good value.
Well, and it sounds like if not for little ones, it might still be with us today.
That's my suspicion. I obviously, that's a theme in my what you love, is I like Logitech products, and they generally fare very, very well. They also have, it also has programmable buttons, which I don't use a lot, but it also has a mute button right on the side, which is to hit. You can just mute your mic real quick with a tap and not have to come out of the game or anything. So give that a shot if you game a lot or wear your headset for hours at a time.
Very cool. Yeah.
Jacob, what do you love?
Well, I think I got to switch it up at the last minute. And I do want to say that I concur with you. I'm a fan of Logitech. I've owned a lot of Logitech stuff over the years. And, I mean, you really can't go wrong, especially for the money. It's usually pretty decent stuff. I was going to say this thing I love is an inexpensive little nylon belt that I just picked up off of Amazon because I needed a summer belt as the weather gets nicer, not wearing a big heavy leather belt everywhere. But I have to change it because about a week and a half ago, I was at one of my physical therapy appointments for my shoulder, and the therapist told me to get something that has changed my life. It is amazing. Ooh. He had me doing some exercises, and he said that part of the problem with my posture is that my thoracic something or other is too tight. And a way that you can fix that is you stretch it out. And so he had me get a foam roller. So you need like a 3-foot-long by 8-inch medium to high density foam roller, and you can get one on Amazon for like $19. And I did, and got it sent right to my house. And you sit down and you just kind of put it about midway up your back, so it's going across you, so you kind of look like a T, and then you stretch your back over it, and you get, like, when you get it in just the right place, like, my whole back just, I can feel it relax, and like it'll pop 7 or 8 times, and it just feels like someone is like just stretching me in half, and it feels so, so good. So I changed it at the last minute. I made an audible because before I jumped on to do the podcast, I was in stretching my back, and doggone it, does it not feel amazing. So I had never used one of these. I've heard about them, never used one of these foam rollers before, and I am absolutely converted now. I am a believer. They are amazing. So you got to get yourself one of these dense, like 8-inch foam rollers, and you can, apparently there's websites that teach you how to use it to roll out all kinds of stuff all over your body. And I feel like the majority of our listeners are probably middle-aged guys who have all kinds of aches and pains and knots and muscles that are in positions that they shouldn't be in. And gosh, you got to check one of these out. They're amazing. So I'll put a link to it. That is what I love. It
sounds awesome. Good. And that's interesting because when I was in therapy for my shoulder, I used some of those, but I used them lengthwise.
Yeah, he had me doing some stuff on that too, where you lay on it and then like you bring your arms to your side, so it gives you a stretch. There's a whole bunch of different things you can do with that.
Something and up and
yep.
Interesting.
Yep, but if you lay on it the other way. So it's not lengthwise, it's widthwise.
Mm-hmm. Crosswise.
And,
yeah.
And you'll find a place somewhere. I mean, you got to kind of just adjust it and play with it where you just kind of rock back. You kind of put your hands behind your head so you support your neck and you just lean back almost like you're doing a back bend. And you'll hit it just right and your whole back, like it'll just go pop, 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 pop. And you'll go, oh, what just happened? And then you'll go, oh, I think I like that.
Nice.
And it when it happens, oh, it's good stuff. All right, so we have reached the end of another episode. We would like to invite you to call in with your comments, questions, rants, and raves at our call-in comment line. That number is 317-643-1212. Thanks again, Howie, for the call. We always appreciate those. We will listen to them all and put it on an upcoming show if you would like. It's a good way to get in touch with the show and feel like you are participating. Follow us on Twitter at NoBetterShow. Visit our blog at www.nobettershow.com. Send us an email. We like emails, the old-fashioned kind. feedback@nobettershow.com. We read them all, and we will put it on the air and make you internet famous. Tell your friends, podcast listening and non-podcast listening alike, about the show. And if you would go subscribe, rate, and leave a review on iTunes, we would greatly appreciate it. Those kind words and handfuls of stars that we get every now and then go a long way towards helping us out and keeping the audience growing. Hopefully now that you have listen to the Know Better Than Average podcast, you know better than average as well. Have a great week, everybody.
Talk at you later, everyone.